This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. So we're going to talk about one of the more important campaigns early in the Civil War today, and that is the Shenandoah Valley Campaign. So let's kind of start at the beginning, set the strategic level stage for us as we go into this campaign.
Okay, in January 1862, basically you got a situation where you've had the sort of the first campaign season of the war. Didn't go so well for the United States. They lost the Battle of First Manassas in Virginia. They lost the Battle of Wilson's Creek out in Missouri. And so they bring in a new commander by the name of George McClellan. And George McClellan goes into the process of building a new army. And this takes quite a while. And much longer than the president and many of the people in Washington think it should take. And when 1862 begins, McClellan is preparing his army for operations, where to be determined, because he and Lincoln are going to have a significant disagreement about that. McClellan decides he wants to take his army down to the lower Chesapeake Bay, operate against Richmond from the east. Lincoln does not like that idea because he worries about, he thinks McClellan should fight the enemy closer to Washington as opposed to closer to Richmond. McClellan's logic is, if we're threatening Richmond, they're not going to threaten Washington or Northern Virginia. So it's a fundamental conflict that's going to be between that Lincoln is going to have with many of his generals throughout the war. Where do we fight the enemy, closer to Richmond or closer to Washington? Mm-hmm. Critical to this whole debate is the Shenandoah Valley. If you look at the geography of Virginia, you've got the Chesapeake Bay, the great geographic features. From there, you head east up the rivers into the Virginia Tidewater until you reach the fall line, which is at Alexandria, Virginia, right across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. It's at Fredericksburg on the Rappahannock, and it's at Richmond on the James River. And once you pass the fall line, you enter what's called the Virginia Piedmont region, which ends at the Blue Ridge. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the Blue Ridge is the Shenandoah Valley, which separates the Blue Ridge from the Allegheny Mountains. And the way the Shenandoah Valley is geographically is it runs from the southwest to the northeast. So if you're in the Shenandoah Valley going north, the Shenandoah River flows north, so you're said to be going down the valley when you're heading north and up the valley if you're headed south. And the Shenandoah Valley, because of its orientation and the continuation of the valley north of the Potomac River, with Blue Ridge becoming South Mountain, it kind of provides a natural invasion route, potential invasion route. Not invasion route in terms of occupying territory, but conducting raids into Maryland and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And if you manage to cross the Potomac and then turn east and you pass through the South Mountain, you're headed towards Washington. Mm-hmm. So it's a place where the North can't win the war, because if you push up the Shenandoah Valley, there's only so far you can go before you start running out of military objectives, mm-hmm. That are of any value. Whereas contrary for the South, for the North, the further north they push, the more the richer the objectives
right,
are.
Right, right.
So it's going to be very, very important for that to be defended. And that is a big concern that President Lincoln has, is the security of Northern Virginia if McClellan takes the army down to the peninsula. Also, within Lincoln's logic, it's better to fight the enemy closer to you than further away from you. And he sees if Confederate forces move down the Shenandoah Valley and into Maryland and Pennsylvania, they could possibly be vulnerably defeated.
So let me ask an ignorant European historian question. In this kind of terrain feature in Western Europe, there'd be a giant fortress at the north end of the valley. Mm-hmm. Why is there not here?
Because no one ever thought we were going to have to fight for the Shenandoah Valley. Who is the enemy of the United States as going to be conducting military operations in the Shenandoah Valley? Now, when settlement in the colonial period was moving out from the Tidewater into the Piedmont and the Shenandoah Valley, the colonial authorities did construct a series of fortifications. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those are old Indian posts and are long gone. Although their names are still there in terms of some of the communities in the Shenandoah Valley and the mountains.
They wouldn't stand up to mid-19th century canon?
Oh, no. These were, if you go to Fort Necessity out mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, kind of like that. If you send an army out there, if they established a fortified position, it was something like a little stockade.
Yeah, a little wooden stockade.
Where you could rally your guys as, they'd camp on the outside, they'd spend all the time on the outside, but if they got attacked, then they could defend the stockade. But nothing like the permanent fortifications that you see in Europe.
Okay. So you already talked about this difference in strategy mm-hmm. between the civilian authority and the military authority. How are the leaders in the South looking at the situation they're facing, McClellan's army invading, and where the valley fits into that?
Well, McClellan's army is not invading. They're going to preserve the Union for the benefit of the people of the South and the entire Union.
Right.
Okay. And again, there's assumption of the North that they can win the war in 1862 mm-hmm. through decisive military success and also through a conciliatory policy. You know, don't attack slavery, don't attack Southern property, and sort of a carrot and stick approach. Mm-hmm. The carrot is you return to the Union, no penalty, and so there's no point in you fighting. And if you do fight, McClellan's going to build this huge army, mm-hmm. and that will be the stick. And faced with that decision, Southerners will return to the Union.
So is the defeat mechanism then destruction of a Confederate army in Northern Virginia or seizure of a particular point?
Demonstrate Southern military impotence mm-hmm. is really it's you know, we tried to do it quick and dirty, right, through, and again, to stress it, that was sort of the idea behind the first Manassas campaign. Yeah. You go out, you win a quick battle, and you show that the Confederate leaders are a bunch of, guys who can't defend their own country. Mm-hmm. Hold out the olive branch, and Southerners go, yeah, that was a pretty stupid thing for us to do. Mm-hmm. And how dare those slaveholders lure us into this situation? Mm-hmm. Well, after First Manassas, you got a situation where, they think they can win. So McClellan says, okay, so we've got to take this. A census says we've got a 5-2 advantage in military manpower. We've got the industry. We've got the resources. So let's just use that to demonstrate their military impotence. Capture Richmond, do all these things. And if they can't defend their capital, then Southerners will think, okay, if the Confederate leaders can't defend the capital and the North is not demanding any penalty from us, we can come back to the Union. Mm-hmm. And so that's the basic idea. And it's there that McClellan begins his campaign. But of course, Lincoln is very concerned if the Army of the Potomac goes down to the lower Chesapeake Bay, who's going to defend Washington? Mm-hmm. Now, you had your question about fortifications. McClellan had initiated and pushed forward a fortification system for Washington, D.C. when he was in command in addition to building the army. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of an economy of force measure. This would enable to leave smaller forces behind the fortifications. The Confederates don't have much in terms of engineering capability.
Right.
And even when the Confederates had their main army in Northern Virginia, Manassas and Centerville, they could not attack Washington before these fortifications were constructed. So the idea is Washington be fortified, you go down and conduct operations, and Washington be relatively secure. Mm-hmm. Of course, they couldn't undertake the same kind of fortification effort you suggest in the Shenandoah Valley. It just seemed like, what would be the point?
Right.
If the war's going to be over in a year, we'll build all these fortifications, and, what's the point?
Right.
The Shenandoah Valley had to be neutralized. And so you had a federal force out there under the command of Nathaniel Banks, and you have a Confederate force out there under the command of Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson. And these are the two Army commanders who are going to duel in the Shenandoah Valley.
Okay, so let's talk
briefly about what happens on the peninsula while the Valley Campaign is going on. So could you give us kind of a brief run through of what McClellan does once he gets this giant army on land?
Second half of March, McClellan begins transferring the Army of the Potomac to the to Fort Monroe, which is at the tip of the peninsula formed by the York and James Rivers. In the first week of April, he begins operations moving up the peninsula, and he conducts a month-long siege of a Confederate position at Yorktown. Lincoln, who has been impatient with McClellan, finds these siege operations, he finds these taking too long.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lincoln's impatience with this, some of the anxiety, and a whole big problem develops because McClellan has developed a plan for defending Washington, and Lincoln insisted on this when he agreed to McClellan, let McClellan go to the peninsula. And McClellan's plan was for the force in the Shenandoah Valley, commanded by Nathaniel Banks, to move east of the Shenandoah, to push to Winchester. Once it had forced Jackson's much smaller force to retreat and fall back from the lower Shenandoah Valley, then Banks's command would move to northern Virginia, mm-hmm. which would enable more of McClellan's army to go to the peninsula.
Hmm.
On March the 23rd, Stonewall Jackson attacks Banks's command. He's defeated badly. However, the fact that Jackson attacked leads McClellan to tell Banks to stay in the Shenandoah Valley until Jackson is dealt with. Now, Jackson retreats far up the valley to a position called Rood's Hill. So the valley is secure, but it leads to, if Banks is going to stay in the valley instead of go to northern Virginia to be in front of Washington, who's going to be in front of Washington?
Mm-hmm.
The commander of the District of Washington, James Wadsworth, becomes very concerned. As McClellan's taking his army down the peninsula, he's got the plan for having four corps with him. And when they look at the defenses of Washington, they report that McClellan had not left as many forces behind as had been expected. So Lincoln holds back a corps from McClellan's army. And this becomes a big controversy between McClellan and Lincoln, because McClellan had planned to use that corps in his operations against Yorktown to make those much quicker and much more decisive.
Mm-hmm. So let's just kind of get an appreciation for kind of the size of the forces spread across mm-hmm. the battlefield. So McClellan's got three corps on the peninsula?
Yes.
He's got an additional corps plus garrison forces in D.C.
Yes.
And then, so what's out in the valley with Banks?
In the Shenandoah Valley, you have what was called, what in March of 1862 was organized as the 5th Corps of the Army of the Potomac. It consists of two divisions, one commanded by Alpheus Williams, the other commanded by James Shields. And like I said, it was originally organized as the 5th Corps Army of the Potomac. But in April, when McClellan goes to the peninsula, Lincoln decides to hold back the corps commanded by Irvin McDowell. There's a reorganization, and McClellan loses control of Banks' command, which becomes an independent department of the Shenandoah, and Irvin McDowell's corps becomes the department of the Rappahannock.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, in the mountains of the Allegheny Mountains, there is a mountain department commanded by John C. Fremont,
mm-hmm.
Who has the mission of marching from the mountains south and west and reach Knoxville.
Now, are these identical corps, reasonably the same, or is, in other words, is Union Corps a Union Corps? Are they, are these very different organizations?
The Union Corps on the, as I said, Banks' command has basically two divisions in it. McDowell's corps starts with two divisions and will eventually have three. One of the divisions under Banks' command, James Shields' division, is eventually going to be ordered to go to McDowell's command. So McDowell can go from Northern Virginia after occupying Fredericksburg and Falmouth, headed south and join McClellan on the peninsula that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the Shenandoah Valley campaign becomes comes critical, because Jackson's command in late May is able to defeat Banks's command at the battles of Front Royal and the Battle of Winchester. And when that happens, McDowell's ordered to send two of his divisions to the Shenandoah Valley instead of marching to join McClellan.
So who are these men commanding these Union armies? You mentioned Fremont, Banks, and McDowell. Fremont is an experienced fighter from the Mexican War, but who are they as commanders?
It is inaccurate to call Fremont a fighter.
Yeah.
Because Fremont's a remarkable individual. He gets as you guys have studied, after the War of 1812, for the most part, West Point graduates get almost all the commissions in the Army. Fremont is an exception. Mm-hmm. He manages to get commissioned in the Army. He strategically marries the daughter of Thomas Hart Benton, who is the big Western expansionist governor of Missouri. Mm-hmm. Not governor, senator from Missouri. Old Bullion Benton, they called him. Friend of Andrew Jackson. And in part thanks to Benton's sponsorship, Fremont gets assigned to do these exploration operations, to conduct mapping expeditions in the far west, and he's very good at public relations and becomes known as the Pathfinder. And he never really commands in combat the way Winfield Scott did in the war, or Zachary Taylor did. Mm-hmm. He gets involved in a lot of other things.
California.
California, right, in the Bear Flag Revolt. Mm-hmm. But Fremont, as a very individualistic, does not fit very well into the professionalizing Army. He has controversy, there's court martials, things like that, and eventually leaves the Army and goes into politics, becomes a senator from California, and becomes the first Republican nominee for president mm-hmm. in 1856. Mm-hmm. So when the war begins, he's definitely in high command in the Union Army. Mm-hmm. Nathaniel Banks is another person who has no military experience, no West Point experience. He was known as the Bobbin Boy of Massachusetts because he rose from working as a factory worker to becoming a politician. He was a governor, and he was the first Republican elected Speaker of the House. Hmm. And so when the war begins, he's going to get a high command.
Right.
The other is Irvin McDowell. Irvin McDowell is a West Point graduate. He serves in the Mexican War, and he very much follows the professionalizing role. I think he goes to France and studies there. He spends most of his time as a staff officer, which again is considered a valuable appointment for mm-hmm. for aspiring generals because they serve at the hand of generals and get to see generalship.
Right.
But what McDowell's most important quality is the fact that he is from Ohio. In 1861, the Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase, is a man who doesn't stay in his lane and has a lot of influence over military appointments, mm-hmm. wants to make sure an Ohioan gets an important appointment, and so Irvin McDowell gets command of the army that fights at Manassas. He's defeated, but a lot of people afterwards don't really blame him. Mm-hmm. There's a large sense that, okay, we pushed out too hard, we went out too fast, we were too impatient, and you really couldn't blame McDowell.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain why we have so many people who had maybe prior military experience and mm-hmm. then left military and now are back in, or just straight up political appointments into these senior level positions? Why are these guys there? Why aren't we pulling from the professional officer class to fill all the command slots?
Well, one is politics. You want to build support for the war effort. You want to reward, political supporters. You want to, what evidence is there that the West Point graduates will necessarily make better generals? Lincoln does respect the expertise that West Pointers bring. Mm-hmm. You see him consistently appointing these guys to command the armies. But in addition, there's also these other considerations that Lincoln's got to deal with.
Mm-hmm. It's also just a bigger army, right?
Yeah, and again, what evidence that you have that a West Point graduate in his 40s has the leadership qualities when you got politicians who, they can handle the bureaucracy, or they can hire staff to handle the bureaucracy mm-hmm. and have the kind of, and again, Nathaniel Banks, he hasn't read textbooks on managing armies or fighting campaigns, but there's a sense in America that a lot of warfare is just common sense. Obviously, if you have a choice between attacking a guy direct on or hitting on his flank, it's obvious you hit him on the flank. Mm-hmm. Was it Joe Manier Clausewitz says these things aren't that difficult to figure out, right? The execution is the problem, and that's when you need management and administration and bureaucratic people make sure the paperwork works, logistics are come up, the supplies are all there. But again, you don't get a lot of books on warfare in the 19th century talking about staff officers and staff functions and staff capacity.
So let's pull this down just a little bit. Yep. So we've talked about the commanders a little bit yep. and all these kind of guys. So what about the soldiers? How good are these units? Where you talk about warfare is kind of a common sense thing. Yep. So pick a random regiment or a vanilla regiment from Banks's command in the valley.
Best known,
what do they look like?
Best known regiment in Banks's command is probably the 2nd Massachusetts. And it's well known because Robert Gould Shaw is in it. And it's also, you know, it's a Massachusetts regiment, highly educated area. And we get a lot of letters from the members of the 2nd Massachusetts. You know, raised the way a typical regiment would be raised. I mean, you local leaders raise a company of troops, and they, with some expectation that they'll be elected their captains. Mm-hmm. And the people who assist them will become their lieutenants. And Robert Gould Shaw becomes a lieutenant in the 2nd Massachusetts, social stature, things like that. You know, if you, and the assumption that if you were effective in civilian life, that should translate to the military. Mm-hmm. Once again, West Point graduates, there's a suspicion of West Point in the 19th century that West Point, you know, it made good bureaucrats and good managers and good engineers, but in becoming an engineer or a bureaucrat, you may have become something of a nerd, which means you have lost what it took to be a really successful commander.
Yeah.
The sense of spirit and connection with the ability to connect with people that politicians have, right? Mm-hmm. They can connect people, they can lead them. And so there's an assumption that should translate to military generalship. Mm-hmm. But the 2nd Massachusetts was composed of, you know, recruits from the state of Massachusetts. Generally, you would start raising your unit at the company level. The companies would be brought together by the governors to form regiments. And then the regiments would be officered by appointees by the governor. And then they'd be sent to Washington. And then Washington would combine them into brigades. And then the brigades combined divisions, and if it became necessary, divisions in the Corps to form your armies.
So by the time of the Valley Campaign, take the 2nd Massachusetts, mm-hmm. how long have they been formed and together as an organization before they're sent into combat?
As an organization, the 2nd Massachusetts specifically is part of the, after, the, initially the, there was the call for 90,000 for the 90 days men. 2nd Massachusetts, obviously an early regiment, would have been raised early. But they don't have, you know, long-term military service experience, either they or their officers. Now, generally, they would look for officers, colonels, who would have maybe some Mexican War experience or maybe even West Point experience. Because the first task, obviously, is to get these guys drilled and administered the way they would have been in the Mexican War. So it would have been, so you'd have it raised 1,000 men. And, of course, in the course of training, disease, and things like this, they've probably been down about 500 men in the Valley Campaign, although they might have been a little bit larger.
Mm-hmm. But generally together and trained about a year in the Army yeah. by this point.
Yeah. So well, not quite a year. Probably summer of 61. And then, again, I'm not an expert on the 2nd Massachusetts specifically, but if it was a typical regiment, they would have been raised after in under McClellan's efforts to build the Army of the Potomac and associated commands. So late summer, early fall, through the winter, that would have been the opportunity to have some kind of experience of soldiering.
So let's look at the higher levels of this real quick. Mm-hmm. You mentioned kind of the strategic military overview where you've got these three armies, or maybe four if you want to look at Fremont's that way. You've got Lincoln, you've got McClellan, who has his own army he's commanding. What's between that? Who are the people who are taking these regiments and forming them into brigades, divisions, assigning them to armies, and command and controlling the armies?
The people in between, generally what would happen is, you know, once they came to Washington, the regiments would be combined into brigades or things like that. Or they might have combined it by brigades if there was enough for a governor to send them down there. and generally McClellan would... There are lots of West Point graduates who were looking for to do something besides commanding a regiment. McClellan tended to prefer West Point graduates. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a brigade, like in the Pennsylvania Reserves, they were raised in the summer of 61. Pennsylvania was given a quota for how many troops it was to raise under the 75,000 men initial call. After Fort Sumter, they raised many, many more than that, and held back those that weren't part of the official quota as the Pennsylvania Reserves. Mm. And once Pennsylvania Reserves are sent to Washington, they've got a division commander, George McCall, who's an old Mexican War veteran, but they're also assigned under West Point graduates, Brigadier Generals John Reynolds, George Meade, they are assigned, McClellan tends to look for West Point graduates to command the brigades and the divisions.
Mm-hmm.
His preference is for younger men who are his relative same age, which creates tensions because there are officers in the Army who have been commissioned in the 1820s. And McClellan's going to generally try to work around them, but Lincoln's going to insist on that. As tensions develop between Lincoln and McClellan, these older generals feeling a little bit resentful towards McClellan and his quote-unquote pets
mm-hmm.
will tend to be much more sympathetic and friendly to Republicans who are looking for dissenting voices in the Army. So it injects this kind of problem in the Army of Potomac, where you've got these older generals who are not enthusiastic about McClellan, and they've got division commanders under them who are enthusiastic about McClellan, and it creates a real awkward problem in the Peninsula campaign.
No, it certainly makes sense. Let's flip this around and let's talk about the other army. It's probably a silly question to ask about Stonewall Jackson and his background, but could you walk us through the opposition that the American forces are going to face?
Okay. Critical, there are two significant commands here. Three, actually. There is a force in the Western Mountains around west of the town of McDowell, under the called the Army of the Northwest, which is a very small force under command of Brigadier General Edward Johnson, who's nicknamed Old Allegheny because he wins some short battles with some Federals out there. So they're out there in the mountains west of Stanton. And then you've got Stonewall Jackson's Valley District, which is a district which is a subcommand of the Department of Northern Virginia, which Joe Johnston commands, and is the main Confederate force in the Virginia Piedmont and Virginia Tidewater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when McClellan's army lands at the peninsula, Johnston is ordered to go to the peninsula to defend Yorktown. He leaves behind in Northern Virginia a division commanded by Richard S. Ewell. And Ewell's command will be behind the Rappahannock and Rapidan Rivers, and their job is to watch Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you've got these forces all dispersed and divided and separated means in April, when the Federals take the offensive, in mid-April, Irvin McDowell decides he wants to occupy Falmouth and the town of Fredericksburg, big mm-hmm. logistical hubs. And Banks pushes south up the Shenandoah Valley. Jackson cannot stop Banks, and Ewell cannot do anything about what McDowell is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution becomes obvious. And facilitating this is a fellow by the name of Robert E. Lee, who will do some things in the Civil War that people might have heard of. But in March, he's brought to Richmond, and he becomes basically Jefferson Davis's military advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at the situation. Johnston is so focused on his force. Lee is going to be the guy who's really going to coordinate, look at things in Virginia broadly. And Ewell has orders to, hold your position there, but also think about going to help Jackson in the valley, but also don't forget, you also might be also called to help down the peninsula. And finally, in late April, it's decided that Ewell will go join Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley. And so he moves to the Shenandoah Valley, which changes the situation, because now Jackson's got a strong enough force that he can perhaps do something against Banks and Fremont's commands.
So what force structure does Jackson have in the Valley, and then what does Ewell bring to that?
Jackson commands what's called the Valley District, which consists of basically three brigades. It's a small force. It's the force he attacks at Kernstown with on March 23rd and is defeated. And then Banks is able to push him relatively easy up the valley.
So remembering that Banks has a core of about two to three divisions.
Two divisions.
And Jackson has a division, basically, under his command, although smaller, probably.
Yeah, relatively small, about 4,000 to 5,000 men. Now, what's going to happen in April of 1862 is the Confederacy is going to, the governor of Virginia and the Confederate government are going to real effort to push and raise forces, which culminates in the Conscription Act that they passed, the first Conscription Act in United States history, to try to swell these forces. But the critical thing that happens with Jackson is Ewell's command becomes available to him. But again, it's complicated because Ewell's command still technically belongs to Johnston. They all belong to Johnston's command.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, if Jackson's going to use Ewell, the question is whether Ewell will also be available to go to Richmond as well, or possibly deal with the Federals. It's just a complicated situation.
Who's in command?
Technically, who's in command is Joseph Johnston. As the commander of the Department of Northern Virginia, the Valley District belongs to him. The forces defending at Yorktown belong to him, and Ewell's command belongs to him.
But when Ewell and Jackson come together, is Ewell placed underneath Jackson, or is it a cooperate situation?
Ewell agrees to place himself under Jackson's command.
Which is an interesting way to look at military relations.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Valley District is, you know, Ewell's has been on the east side of the Blue Ridge. Jackson has been on the west side of the Blue Ridge. And Ewell is sent south to cooperate with Jackson. Jackson, senior in rank as a district commander, as a division commander. And so consequently, Ewell naturally comes under his command. At the same time, there is that tension that Ewell's division is a separate command as part of Johnson's army. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned kind of the opening phase. Jackson launches this attack. It fails. He has to retreat. Ewell reinforces him. Where do we go from here?
All right. So Jackson, after he has been driven south of the valley, he takes a position in a place called Conrad's Store. Now, the Shenandoah Valley between the towns of Strasburg, Winchester is the main town in the lower Shenandoah Valley. Mm-hmm. But once you go south of Winchester, a tall ridge by the name that's called Massanutten Mountain splits the valley in two. On the east side is what's known as the Luray or Page Valley, and at the head of the northern head of that is the town of Front Royal. On west of the Massanutten Mountain, you've got the Shenandoah Valley, at the head of which is Strasburg. Mm-hmm. And Strasburg and Front Royal are connected by a railroad that passes through Manassas Gap, heads to what's called Manassas Junction, and links up with the Orange and Alexandria Railroad that leads to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So that's basically the situation. And the problem is Banks pushes up the Shenandoah Valley after he drives Jackson. Jackson takes a position at Conrad's Store, which is right next to the Blue Ridge, in case Johnston calls him to go to Richmond. But also, when Banks pushes south up the valley, he reaches the town of Harrisonburg, at which point is about the end of where Massanutten Mountain splits the valley. The problem is, at Conrad's Store, Jackson is on his eastern flank, so Banks really can't go further south, and his logisticians are having trouble sustaining him, and Banks says, well, there's not much I can do in the valley anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the Lincoln administration decides to have Banks retreat back towards Strasburg with one division, send another division east to join Irvin McDowell at Falmouth and Fredericksburg, and once Shields' command has joined McDowell, he can march south and join McClellan and finish up the campaign for Richmond, and then whatever happens to the Shenandoah Valley is irrelevant because Richmond's been taken.
Right.
And obviously the Confederates don't want that to happen.
Yeah, right.
And Jackson sees this as an opportunity because once Banks starts pulling back, he is already making a move because Fremont's command is threatening to push in from the mountains to Stanton. And so Jackson moves his command to Stanton, then out to the mountains west near McDowell, and they fight a battle with the lead elements of Fremont's command, forced to fall back to eliminate that threat. Mm-hmm. Jackson then returns to the Shenandoah Valley. He links up with Ewell's command, and with Shields gone, they decide to go after Banks' much reduced command.
So at this point, you see, Banks at this point is essentially an economy of force effort for the federal forces. Basically, don't lose, but hold what you got.
Yeah, we're fine in the Shenandoah Valley. Jackson's command is, you know, we pushed it south. They're not going to be that much of a threat anymore. And besides, for us to go further south, all the way to Stanton, it'd be nice to get Stanton, but you're not going to trade Stanton for Richmond.
And from the Confederate perspective, then, what do they want Jackson's force to do? Do they want to conquer the whole valley? Are they an economy force as well?
Robert E. Lee, from his position in Richmond, encourages Jackson to take the offensive against Banks. But always encouraging, don't attack entrenchments and do it if you can speedily. Johnston, of course, when he's falling back from Yorktown after giving up to McClellan, begins looking to Jackson anti-Ewell, saying, hey, the defense of Richmond. And this leads to a somewhat confusing because in May, when Ewell and Jackson meet up after Jackson has fought the Battle of McDowell, Ewell has received orders to return to east of the Blue Ridge and go to Johnston's assistance. And Ewell places himself under Johnston's command, and Jackson officially places you're officially under command in the Valley District. I'll write to Lee for clarification on this And while we're waiting for that clarification as to Johnston's intention, and Johnston, obviously he's focused on the defense of Richmond, so he can't focus on the problems in the Shenandoah Valley. And so, as soon as that, Jackson and Ewell decide, okay, while we have asked for clarification, let's do what we want to do and go north and go after Banks and see what we can do.
So what we're seeing is that Johnston, kind of the main effort, is starting to need more of, is thinking he might need more manpower. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, that manpower is currently engaged in the Shenandoah Valley, mm-hmm. where even though Banks is a limited effort, mm-hmm. there's still some, he's still a threat.
Yes. Well, I mean, Banks is a threat and an opportunity. Okay, if Banks has been reduced, diminished in forces because he's lost the division, here's an opportunity for us to do something. Mm-hmm. As where Johnston tries to figure out how to deal with McClellan. At Yorktown, Johnston was relatively impotent to do anything about McClellan's command because McClellan's command had the Navy nearby, had heavy artillery, engineering. Johnston really had a hard time figuring out how to stop McClellan. Johnston's idea is, I fall back towards Richmond, McClellan gets extended, maybe I might get an opportunity, but I'm going to need more manpower for this. Mm-hmm. So he starts looking to Ewell's command. He looks at a force that under command of Joseph Anderson, which is defending south of Fredericksburg against McDowell's command and watching McDowell's command. And there's a small force under Lawrence O'Brien Branch, which is out at Gordonsville, which had initially been sent there to take Ewell's place after Ewell went to the valley. And so there's all these moving pieces.
So it almost seems like McClellan's plan is sort of working. They're presenting the Confederate forces with a number of dilemmas, but they have to do something with it.
And on May the 23rd, Lincoln leaves Washington, goes down to Falmouth and Fredericksburg. He visits McDowell's command because Shields' command has finally arrived. And they have this meeting. Lincoln reviews the troops. He loves seeing the troops, reviewing the troops, talking to the troops. He likes talking to Irvin McDowell because Irvin McDowell, unlike George McClellan, is always friendly to him. And so they get together. Lincoln has his famous episode where he walks across this reconstructed bridge that's 400 feet over the Potomac Creek, and everybody else gets dizzy, but Lincoln gets across. And then he has dinner at the Lacey House, and they're all joking and say, "We're ready to go. You're ready to go march on Richmond." They're all ready to march on Richmond. And McDowell goes, "Well, we have to start on Sunday. And Lincoln goes, "Don't worry about it. You can take another day and you'll be ready." And then Lincoln goes back on arrives in Washington on morning of May the 24th. And he receives bad news because on May the 23rd, Jackson's command had attacked Front Royal. Banks had fallen back to Strasburg, posted most of his command at Strasburg, started building fortifications. But he also, to protect Front Royal, which was at the head of the Luray Valley, he sends a small Maryland regiment and some small forces there. As Jackson moves down the valley towards Strasburg, he finds out about how small the forces at Front Royal, and he hits it. And by hitting Front Royal, he's basically cut the railroad between Strasburg and Northern Virginia and placed himself in a position, if he attacks Winchester before Banks can retreat, he might cut Banks off altogether. And it sets up basically a race the next day of Banks' guys trying to get back to Winchester while Jackson's men try to cut him off. It doesn't work. On May the 25th, he does attack Banks' command in the morning, routs it, and Banks' men are flying back towards Washington, towards the Potomac River. Mm-hmm. By the time that happens, Lincoln has told McDowell, "Okay, I know we had a good meeting down there on May 23rd. It was a lot of fun. Ha, ha, ha. Great. But you need to go send Shields guys back to the Shenandoah Valley to go deal with Jackson. And you also will need to send a division back to Washington so they can link up and they can join the effort." And this, so McDowell is basically, as they send this to McClellan, "I'm sorry about this. We were going to send McDowell. We were looking forward to it, but we got to deal with this thing in the Shenandoah Valley."
So the fighting at Strasburg and Front Royal flipped it from the
Winchester
Confederates. Winchester Front Royal prevented the Federals were presenting the Confederates with any number of dilemmas where they were trying to pull all their combat power east. Mm-hmm. Now the Federals are now having to push additional combat power west.
The Winchester, the Front Royal attack, Lincoln initially his response when he finds out, when he gets back to D.C. on May the 24th is, okay, he says to McDowell, okay, maybe you want to leave back a little more forces at Falmouth and Fredericksburg, but we're not to, but then he looks at the map And he said, and he starts thinking, you know what? We've got an opportunity here. If Jackson is pushing, is attacking this far north down the Shenandoah Valley, Fremont's command out to the west could move in from the west and cut him off. If McDowell's command comes from the east, then they could cut him off. And if we could pull this off, fight the enemy closer to us as opposed to farther away like McClellan is doing. And it looks like McClellan on the Shenandoah, on the peninsula, he's reached what's called the Chickahominy River. Very, very difficult river. Very, very difficult operational situation. And, okay, well, McClellan may not be able to achieve anything decisive in the near term. We have an opportunity to achieve something decisive in the near term now. We'll just put that on pause and send McDowell out to the Shenandoah Valley. McDowell's response is, this is, I'm here, they're there, they got the center position. I'm not sure this will work. And he objects strongly to Lincoln, to the point where he says, his message to a certain extent says, I know a subordinate perhaps shouldn't be saying this, but I can't resist pointing out that I don't think I'm going to get there in time. And we're going to do this, and it's going to cost us this plan to get down to Richmond and decide the war there. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln basically says, okay, I got it, but I know this was painful to you, it was painful to me, but just go out and do it. And they very, very nearly pull it off. Jackson decides after Winchester, he rests his men for a couple of days. He pushes north because Lee's orders authorizing him to take action was, if you can menace the frontier of the Potomac, that would do a lot of good. So Jackson pushes towards Harper's Ferry. The Federals hold the position there at Harper's Ferry in pretty good strength. And by the time Jackson is out there at Harper's Ferry, he's thinking about the problem. He finds about Fremont's command that are pushing in towards his rear, and McDowell's guys coming in and begins to make a retreat back up the Shenandoah Valley.
So you described very well kind of the terrain and the strategy and how the operations go up and down the valley. And you mentioned several times how commanders are finding things out. How does that actually work? In fairly rough terrain, you're talking mountains and valleys and ridges. How does the scouting and information gathering work?
That's an excellent question. The initial plan, John C. Fremont's command was at a town called Franklin when he gets the orders from Lincoln. And Fremont's command was organized with the mission of it was called the Mountain Department. To deal with the problem of East Tennessee. East Tennessee was a part of the Confederacy that was anti-Confederate, that was pro-Union. Mm-hmm. They sent a congressman and a senator to Washington who were anti-Confederate. And Lincoln, obviously, is looking for Unionists in the South. Mm-hmm. And obviously, these two Tennesseans are a valuable propaganda to people in the North who want to believe, hey, the Southerners are just, you know, they really do love us down there, right? And there's your brave guys who are standing up to the slave power. Like the Republican Party's job is to stand up to the slave power. So they have a lot of pull. And Lincoln really wants an army to get to East Tennessee. Now, when McClellan was general in chief, the idea was that would happen from west of the mountains. A Union army in Kentucky would advance to Nashville and from Nashville to East Tennessee, and that would take care of the problem. McClellan's removed as general-in-chief in March of 1862. The Western forces come under the command of Henry Halleck, whose focus is on the Mississippi River. He orders the force that was going to go to East Tennessee to help out for the Battle of Corinth. And their arrival is critical because they arrived the day after Grant's initially attacked at Shiloh. But this leaves the question, who's going to deal with East Tennessee? And Lincoln comes with the idea, well, John C. Fremont's popular with Republicans. We'll send him marching south from the mountains of north of West Virginia down through the mountains to to Knoxville, and that'll take care of the problems. Now, if you're saying that sounds like a kind of a crazy idea, from a logistical standpoint,
right.
It's not the best.
Right.
But Fremont needs an important command, and this is an important objective. But once Jackson attacks Banks and defeats him at Front Royal and Winchester, even before the Winchester battle takes place, Lincoln's looking at the map and says, if you move instead to the Shenandoah Valley, you can cut off Jackson's rear. Mm-hmm. And Franklin's command is at a town called Franklin, which is a small little hamlet, county seat in Western Virginia, in a valley. And there's a road that connects it to Harrisonburg, which is well south of Strasburg, and where Jackson's command is going to be at Winchester. The problem is, when Jackson had been operating in the mountains, he had sent a party to, basically a destruction party to the road that connected to Harrisonburg. In addition, Fremont's command in the mountains had problems getting logistics, so instead of marching directly west, he decides to march north, and then from there go to enter at Strasburg, which would still place him behind Jackson's command. Mm-hmm. Now, Lincoln's initially unhappy about this, but that's just the realities. And again, it's the war on a map versus war in reality that you're kind of alluding to, which is Lincoln can look, has his map, and he can see the positions, and it kind of makes sense from a geometric, and Lincoln's big geometry guy, right? He says, this makes total sense, right? Of course, there are differences. Vermont's got to move over mountain roads, which are not good, and Jackson's got the macadamized Valley Turnpike, which is good to have interior lines. So you have a classic interior-exterior line thing, as your friend Jomini mm-hmm. would think of.
Yep.
Which you've got great diagrams, but then you get the terrain, the actual terrain in the mud.
Yeah.
You send scouts to try to see things. Okay, turns out we can't use this road. We're going to have to use this other road. And it creates all these kind of sources of friction.
And what are the sympathies of the local population? And are they a role? Are they providing intelligence and information, or are they just basically a static
in which region?
Let's start with the Shenandoah Valley and then kind of expand out from there.
Shenandoah Valley had been reluctant to support secession in the secession winter, but when Virginia votes to secede, they are. But there's a Unionist population in the Shenandoah Valley. Shenandoah Valley's initial big settlement was by Germans who came from the north. There's a lot of Germans there, a lot of pacifist sects, things like that. And I think Winchester was originally called Frederick. There's a lot of Germans who are, okay, but for the most part, it is a Confederate region, but there are considerable Unionist populations there. What role they play in terms of providing local intelligence, I haven't found much evidence of them providing a great deal of intelligence. The civilians just wanted to kind of be left alone mm-hmm. By the Union Army. Now, what happens is some of those Unionists, when Jackson in April begins trying to enforce the Conscription Act, he tries to go to local militia and make them join the Confederate Army, and Unionists resist, and Jackson's got to dispatch a force into part of Rockingham County to quell this resistance to the Confederate. So the Shenandoah Valley is not, for the most part, it is pro-Confederate, but there are pockets of resistance there.
Okay, so now we, as you say, Jackson is sitting on interior lines. He's dealing with these Union forces that are supposed to converge on him, Lincoln's war on a map. What happens?
What happens is it fails. McDowell's command reaches Front Royal on May the 30th as Jackson realizes, I got to get racing south. Vermont's supposed to come in from the west, but bad weather, poor conditions in his army, they're struggling. Mm-hmm. And Jackson is able to escape the noose basically by one day. He passes through Winchester, passes through Strasburg on June the 1st. He sends a force out under Richard Ewell to watch Vermont's command, and they put up enough of a show that Vermont's guys are kind of held up, and this enabled Jackson's command to escape south using the Valley Pike through Strasburg and keep moving south up the Shenandoah Valley.
And so Jackson is able to move so much faster simply because he has this improved road?
That is to a large extent what happened. And once Vermont's guys reach the Valley Pike, there's commentary on, of course, they get really bad weather.
Right.
So Jackson's commands, that's going to take a big effect on the roads. But we have Vermont's guys who are saying that the Valley Pike, this is so much better than the mountains, the roads we've been using. Of course, just using those roads, they've got them exhausted already.
Right.
And so as Jackson's retreating south from Strasburg, part of McDowell's command, Shields' command, pushes south up the Luray Valley on one side of Massanutten, and Vermont pursues on the other side of the Shenandoah Valley, pursuing Jackson directly. The idea is hopefully at some point you'll get them in a pincer.
Right.
But again, the interior lines, exterior lines issue comes up. Mm-hmm. Jackson's able to retreat back to Port Republic, which places him in a good interior position. Ewell's command fights off Vermont's command on the 8th of June at Cross Keys. After that, he brings Ewell's command over. They attack Shields' command at Port Republic. Shields retreats, Vermont retreats, and the Valley Campaign is over.
Okay, so we've finished the fighting. How does this fit into the overall strategic picture of the fighting in early 1862? What does the Valley mean to what's happening elsewhere in Virginia?
Well, it means something to not just in Virginia, because when Frémont is sent to the Valley, that creates once again the question of who's going to take care of East Tennessee. Mm-hmm. On May the 30th, Henry Halleck's command had occupied Corinth. And once they occupied Corinth in North Mississippi, the question becomes what to do next. And basically, Halleck divides his command back to the way it was before he took command. Ulysses S. Grant's army in West Tennessee, Don Carlos Buell's command, will now march towards Chattanooga mm-hmm. and East Tennessee. They're going to have problems, all kinds of logistical problems. There's a huge drought, and they're not going to reach East Tennessee. And basically that sets up the war in the West, because Buell's command is going to be the force that becomes under William S. Rosecrans. It's eventually going to liberate East Tennessee, fight the battles of Chattanooga and Chickamauga, while Grant's command, of course, conducts the operations against Vicksburg. Mm-hmm. They capture that. And the overall strategic situation in Virginia, once after the battles of Port Republic and Cross Keys, Lincoln directs, Shields' command, return to Front Royal, and then Humpty Dumpty will put it back together again. Now you can go to McDowell again. Frémont, you're going to stay here, and you're going to go to Strasburg and hold the position Banks initially held. And Banks' command, which had retreated back across the Shenandoah River, mm-hmm. the Potomac River after Winchester, has returned now that Jackson's gone. You'll occupy a position at Front Royal. And a position at Front Royal, a position at Strasburg, we'll put it back together again. The Shields can once again go to McDowell, and this time the Shenandoah Valley will be secure. Mm-hmm. Now, it's going to take time to do this, during which Robert E. Lee, who replaces Joe Johnston after Joe Johnston is wounded at the Battle of Fair Oaks, Lee orders Jackson to come to Richmond and fight against McClellan. It leads to the 7 days battles, and that leads to basically the end of McClellan's Peninsula campaign.
And Jackson's able to move from the Shenandoah because there's nobody able to come south and hit him at that time.
Well, initially Lee sent some reinforcements to Jackson. If you can do something more, and then it becomes clear that Jackson can't accomplish anything more in the Shenandoah Valley. It's okay to just bring him to Richmond, and we will try to use you to determine McClellan's position, and that, I guess, it sets up the 7 days battles on the fight for Richmond.
So the Valley Campaign for a long time was taught as kind of this masterclass of operational level warfare mm-hmm. on the part of Jackson. Do you buy that, and why or why not?
Masterclass and campaign. First of all, it is, along with the Vicksburg Campaign, it is probably the best operational level campaign of the American Civil War to study. Just the way Jackson uses interior lines and the larger effects it has on the larger campaign in Virginia, it is just an incredible campaign. Jackson is not perfect in the campaign. Mm-hmm. There are times when he's a little hesitant at Front Royal, and you can understand that because his first battle at Kernstown, he kind of rushed into the battle and got beaten badly. But again, he's dealing with fog, friction, uncertainty. And so there's lots of teaching opportunities of the Shenandoah Valley campaign. And again, it's one of these great campaigns where you get events, you get to draw arrows, and it's a lot of fun to study. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's very much at the operational level where Jackson demonstrates considerable effective leadership there.
So other than the successful use of interior lines and the leadership, as you mentioned, what should military professionals take away from this campaign?
Should they take away from this campaign? Well, again, you named some of them. Interior lines, leadership, understanding your mission, understanding the willingness to take initiative, to see the areas of initiative within the orders you're given. The difficulty of conducting operations on exterior lines from the federal side mm-hmm. is, and also the civil-military ties. Just how the politics of the high command, the Union high command, is always a fascinating subject, and how these guys interact, the president, his efforts to try to develop his thinking militarily. It does to a certain provide in a way for Lincoln a way of thinking about the war. Do I want to fight the Confederates closer to Richmond, or do I want to fight them closer to Washington? Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are optics for fighting them further north, which are a problem, but there are operational opportunities from that as well. There are optics of fighting them in front of Richmond, but there are also challenges there as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where should the priority be in Union? Now, in 1864, they're going to have the Shenandoah Valley campaign, in which, at the time, Grant is not unsimilar to McClellan, engaged in a campaign of trenches and things like that in front of Richmond and Petersburg and rivers and joint operations, or at least when McClellan wants to be joint operations. And then you have problems in the Shenandoah Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln decides in both cases the priority and the opportunity is greater in the Shenandoah Valley for quicker results.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the Gettysburg campaign. You know, Lincoln initially looks at the Gettysburg campaign not as a, when Lee goes into Pennsylvania, not as a bad thing, but as an opportunity, which is one of the reasons he's so frustrated when not as much is accomplished as he hoped would be.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Lincoln's developing thinking about warfare. Again, it gets into questions of organization, of operations, of logistics, and obviously the operational art we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And also thinking about things such as culmination points and sequencing and things like that. So it's all great stuff for the organizational, operational leader to think about.
Yeah, it very much sounds like it. Dr. Rafuse, thank you for joining us.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.